Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. For more information and to get the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is a special episode 15, where me and Miranda were joined by Professor Jorgen Sandberg of Queensland University in Australia to discuss ideas surrounding his thinking about what is interesting research and how one might go about operationalizing it in practice and to what end. We recorded this episode back in June, actually exactly 2 months ago as of today, when Jorgen was visiting Warwick Business School to give a couple of seminars. Because of this, you might hear some construction traffic in the background here and there, but in any case, in this episode we talk about a number of Jorgen's works on the subject, but mainly focusing on his 2013 book, co-written with Mats Alveson and published by Sage. The book is Constructing Research Questions, Doing Interesting Research. We strongly recommend that you get your hands on a copy of this, as it's highly relevant and well worth the time and money. Even if you're not an active researcher, this book, as Jorgen explains later in the episode, is great for getting people to think about various assumptions they operate on and how those might prevent more interesting thinking. There are some practical suggestions for overcoming those Plato's caves of specialist thinking that seem so common now and just plain good writing. For those of our listeners who may not know Jorgen, he is a professor at the University of Queensland Business School in Australia, a great scholar and a lovely human being. He is very widely published and did some very significant work on professionals, competencies and more recently on these philosophical and methodological foundations of research. You can find his profile on our website under the About the Podcaster section and do have a look at the list of suggested readings for this episode on the episode page, as Jorgen actually proposed pretty much all of those. So thank you for joining myself and Miranda as we sit down with Jorgen Sandberg and enjoy the episode. Welcome, Jorgen, and thank you for agreeing to be a guest on our podcast.
My pleasure.
So the theme of our special today is very much into what you're presenting now. You're now at Warwick giving a series of seminars. It's on doing interesting research and what that entails and what that means primarily, which is fascinating because, as you pointed out in the book and in the journal article, everyone wants to do interesting research.
That's true.
Would you like to start us off by just saying in a few words what you mean by that and why you decided to pursue this
doing agenda? Interesting research?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that this story behind is that a colleague of mine, Mats Alveson, and myself, we were looking at a lot of research coming out from the business schools and elsewhere, and we found them very boring,
right,
and dull and didn't say very much. And we were quite intrigued by the fact that there was so much coming out, but not so much interesting stuff. And then we read an article by Murray Davis, a sociologist in 1971, called That's Interesting. And because we found that, because we were intrigued, what makes some theories interesting and others not? See if we can untangle this boring research and find out what's going on, why some other people don't do so much interesting research. And we were quite inspired by his work, and because he could identify why some theories are seen as interesting and becoming influential, coming into textbooks and so on, and others just forgotten. And we saw that what he was saying, that to be interesting is not to produce theories that are true, but theories that are interesting in the sense they actually challenge some assumptions underlying existing literature. So what his formula said, that we thought it was this, but it's actually that. And then we say, aha, that's interesting. So then we started looking into the literature and see how do other people do research. And then we discovered, as we write in the book and other ways, that people mainly not doing problemization or questioning. They do what we call gap spotting, which means that they spot a gap in the literature and trying to fill that. And that makes incremental adding to the literature. But that's not so interesting, but because it doesn't challenge assumptions. And those people or theories that become known and impactful are mainly those that in some way or another challenge assumptions.
This is really interesting stuff, and I'm particularly relating to it because of my own work. I told you yesterday that I realized listening to you that I have actually been problematizing for the duration of my PhD. One of the things that I want to follow up on is we actually had some of our listeners ask us to ask you some things relating to that. And you mentioned that kind of the opposition, I suppose, between interesting and boring research. Which you seem to have a good idea of what interesting research is, and I think we generally do, or we can identify interesting stuff. What do you think is boring research?
Well, I mean, if you can follow Davis, he says that boring research is that doesn't challenge anything as any assumption. It's just more of the same. And you get the feeling that they just reiterate the same issues over and over again with some very little twist on it. But we already know this, and often we look at it, it's highly irrelevant too, because it doesn't make much impact, and it can be very sophisticated, sometimes with statistics or highly developed qualitative methodologies, but the outcome of it is quite pitiful often. That doesn't lead, I think that's a, and the formalist, the formalic, the kind of almost the way things are written, very dull way to, but it's the broader perspective, the broader which I talked about today, that this is very concerning, because what is our task as researcher? I don't think our task is just to fill gaps, and that it's just to do something more, to actually make a difference in society. I think that's important, and we need to think about that. And I think we have lost our way, as we say in another paper, that we're confusing the goals with the means. So the goal nowadays is to get published, not to say something important.
So I have a question with regard to this idea of impact. And I was wondering, how does the definition of interesting in the sense of challenging assumptions apply to the world of practitioners?
Well, that's a very good question. I've been, actually been thinking about writing something similar, because practitioners also need to challenge their way of doing things, to innovate and to break new grounds, to improve their practice, because they also stand or take for granted, but this is the way we do things here. And I think what we are talking about in the books, how we challenge and assumptions in research, could to a large extent be applied also in business and practice, to challenge practitioners' way of doing things, because they also need to improve and renew themselves. And it's only by challenging the way they are doing things, which means to look at on what assumptions are we basing the way we do things. And they need to start to reflect on that too. And then that's the way often they come up with new things. Like sometimes you see people from an entire different industry goes into another industry, and he or she can then see something, bring with something new, new perspective, and that can open up that industry, and they become a leading industry leader in that way.
Because I was thinking the idea of challenging assumptions applies very much to an academic audience. So my question is, to improve research and to make it more impactful, how can we combine this also with a more practitioner side?
Do you mean putting academic and practitioner into one?
Yeah, I mean, you can do that. You mean to when you sort of problematize academic research, it can also be relevant to that's what you mean. Okay. Well, I think
One size fits all.
That's hard, but I mean, I think you need to ask these questions, like I did myself with this my competence research. That's probably why Harvard Business Review became interested in my article, because I question not only the academic way of looking at competences, I also question how practitioners look at competence. And competence is a very critical thing in industry, because look at human resource management. Competence is the base for that. You need to identify competence in terms of recruitment. You need to identify competence in terms of developing. What kind of competence you develop? You need to identify competence to reward, and who you should lay off if necessary. So you have to have a very clear definition or a good understanding of what competence is there. And they could see, I think obviously knew that what I provided there, what potentially perhaps, how can I phrase it, more accurate, more comprehensive way that could improve the practice there. But I think that goes back to, I mean, when, a more basic thing when you do research, you have to think through, will this question, will this kind of research also have impact on practice if I do something that? Will that make a difference to practice? Whether it's a gap spotting in pronunciation, that really doesn't so much, but if you can also challenge the way practitioners think, perhaps the better, if then in some way they can improve the practice.
I was just wondering, as following up around this question, is that could it be that perhaps practitioners are generally less sensitive or interested in the nuanced aspects of things that they're dealing with? Because we as academics, I suppose, we are very keen on making distinctions and making sure that the shades of colors are as they're supposed to be. Mm. Whereas as a practitioner, you know, you have to get things done.
Yes and no. I think they struggle with this sort of exploitation and explorative thing because they have to exploit and make money of it, but they also have to explore and create new things to survive. So this is a balance there. And if they don't develop new products and whatever services they have, they will not survive. So they have to break new grounds all the time. So that's just a matter of survival. So, and that's, I mean, think, look at Apple. For instance, and what's his name, Steve Jobs, and I mean, the invention of the iPhone, I think that was unthinkable. I mean, you couldn't even think about it. Now everyone uses it. It's like, this is amazing. This is breaking completely new grounds. So I think he challenged the way we communicate and the way we use things, and that's an amazing achievement. And he was able to renew all the time, as an example there.
Yeah. And this is something that you're urging people who do research to do, to problematize existing things and sort of generate unexpected stuff.
Yes, I mean, it's almost like if you have, I'm not sure if you compare research with a factory, but I mean, if the factory is called institutional theory, and then we produce one product after another, a sort of labeled institutional theory. Look at this, is a new piece of institutional theory, and it's such slight variation, but this is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can turn it out quite effectively, but right. It doesn't renew. And in the beginning, it's interesting, it's flashy, but after a while, it's just the same. I mean, now that the same things goes again, institutional logic, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's the same. They need to, so as a researcher, we also need to renew other products. And maybe we need to change theory or problematize that to generate new outcomes. If you take the factory metaphor,
right.
The way we do it.
Well, as you know, I subscribe to your agenda, but just to suggest an antagonist perspective.
Yeah, sure.
Isn't it how science works that you have slow, cumulative, incremental progress where you granted rehash the same thing, but that eventually leads to reliable outcomes? Or do you think that that has a place in natural sciences and not necessarily in social sciences?
It's a hard question. I mean, I think Thomas Kuhn demonstrated that this is not the way research develops, because that's what we thought before, that research is a ginormous jigsaw puzzle, that we are, each of us, contributing with a little piece to the puzzle, and one day maybe the puzzle is fully laid out and look at this is how the world is. But what he demonstrated in science is that it doesn't work like that, because he saw that when it's normal science, yes, there's some kind of jigsaw puzzling process, but then after a while, when you do this, more and more anomalies are coming up. And you can't solve them. You don't know. It's puzzling. You can't understand them within that. And then some person break out and then even change assumptions. And that sort of accommodates and solves the anomalies. So that person starts to develop an alternative paradigm. So it's not going in that cumulative way. It's a new paradigm coming up. And the old knowledge may be maybe not completely useless, but it's forgotten because it's not any longer applicable, because this is the new one. And to some extent, it's even more obvious in the social science, because our research object is almost socially constructed. So it's not that fixed matter. We're construing it all the time. So, but we can still have, as I said, we work in boxes, and there are some theories that can be helpful if you develop that and you sharpen the theory, and we can be more precise in description of predictions or understanding and so on. But you only can go so far. And then after a while, you may see that it has several limitations. And then someone else challenged that. As I said, talk about values, for instance, that may be very good. People have values and you can do a lot of good research there. But then if you do too many of that, well, there's nothing new there. It's the same, just value, value. Then you can maybe take another, not take, but you start to problematize that. Can we see it in different ways? And then have people take value positions. Well, that opens up a new line of production, if you so say so. And that's, I think, how we do it here too. So you can't just invent it all the time. It would be ridiculous, because then, as someone said today here, that there were just different theories and no one has been worked out and fleshed out, elaborated. And I think we need that too, to be helpful for practitioners and ourselves. So we need to work on both levels, sort of. But I think my message and Mats's message is that we need to do much more of questioning, because it's almost everything now is just incremental, adding to the literature, which doesn't make much difference to practitioners, if anything.
So your article dates back to 2011.
Yeah.
That's you published in the Academy of Management Review.
This is 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I was wondering, in 5 years, has it been received well? Has it been accepted? Has it had impact on the academic community? Has it created a bit of debate, discussion?
Yes, I think so, in the sort of different evidence on that. I mean, one evidence is that a lot of editors, Academic Management Journal, Journalists, Behavior, many others, actually taking up and citing it when they're talking about what good research is and what that should be, and as a way to, you should do more of this stuff. I think a lot of it's on in the doctoral programs, used as sort of a text for PhDs, and been quite highly cited, 370 or something in 5 years, and it's crawling up every year. So it's quite a short period of time. It seems to have some impact there.
Well, in this work and in the book as well, the concept of doing interesting research mainly has to do with posing an interesting research question, if you will, so the problematization.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, what about doing interesting research methodologically? What would that look like? Or do you think that follows naturally from the question?
No, I think you can be innovative there too, and sort of challenge the way you do the research process. And we have another piece that is coming out in our handbook, qualitative research handbook, where we're metaphorizing the entire research process and playing around, because we are stuck in metaphors, data, data is like mushrooms, is something fixed, and design's a building design.
You go out and collect data.
That's right. You go out and collect data, like you pick mushrooms and put in a basket and come home. And I mean, that's, we're stuck. We take that for granted. And what we're doing in that piece is to provide a set of alternative metaphors to think about the research process, that how people can enable to open up and see different ways of this, contribution, design, data, text, what it is, and all that stuff, which is important, we think, to start thinking in new ways how you can actually do research, because otherwise it's just one way. But now you can do it in many different ways. And then, as we said before, I mean, it's often seen as a factory, an assembly line. You start to do. But it doesn't need to be like that. It can be a journey, an exploration, rather than a factor, knowledge production.
It's interesting that you seem to be rooting that in language, though.
Yeah.
So it's not the tools or processes, as it were, that, you know, for instance, surveys are less interesting than ethnography or, you know, the other way around if you're someone else, but you're talking about metaphors and how different metaphors changed thinking.
Yes, because it's the way we conceptualize what we do that depends on how we do it. So if you regard data as something out there, then that can be picked up as objective, and then we use certain methods for doing that. So I think it's more important to think about that, how we conceptualize the process, the research process, and the different components there that can help us to think differently about that, and also then come up with different ways of doing research.
Can you give us a taste of some of the metaphors that you're coming up with?
I can't see of that at the moment. I have to go back to was a year ago, so we submitted that now. So
looking for a scoop.
Yes. You have to read.
Yes. Buy the book.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, in the whole idea of challenging assumptions, there may often be the idea of borrowing from other disciplines.
Yeah.
So, as an academic, maybe as a PhD student, someone who's learning the tricks of the trade, do you have any advice to give in terms of belonging to a specific niche of the academic community? Can this cause problems?
How do you mean?
The proverbial boxes.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think one, I don't know, it's not a trick, but it's something you have to read widely. And you have to read different things, not only in your own discipline necessarily, and see if you can get ideas from other disciplines. I mean, quite often, social scientists actually get ideas from natural science, for instance. They use system theory or something that's coming from, or chaos theory is coming from physics, not from the social science, and trying to then reconceptualize the field in terms of that. So I think that's extremely important to visit other fields. And a good book I can recommend actually gives a lot of tips is Andrew Abbott's book, Heuristics, I think he calls it. It's a lot of different tips how you do it, and concrete examples of social scientists have borrowed from other disciplines, creating great new theories, which is kind of problematization and reconceptualization completely. Because problematizers always have to have a different standpoint, otherwise you can't see your own assumptions. It's first like to understand your own culture, you have to go to another culture. Then you start to become aware of how you're influenced by your own culture. It's the same with research. If you sort of embedded in a particular theory or theoretical approach or theoretical school, it's hard to see what that means and the boundary conditions unless you then take another position and read something quite different. Then you can start to see and perhaps appreciate and also be more critical towards your own school. But if you stay in your box, you can never see it. It's like a fish in the water. When the fish in the water will never the last one to see the water.
Mm-hmm. But then it only seems to work that once you're in this box, you can venture slightly outside in order to look back at your box. But if you want to go elsewhere entirely, then that's a bit trickier because that's something I wanted to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, say I want to switch specialities entirely. The amount of time and effort it would take me to gain working knowledge of the new specialty would actually reprogram my brain, if you will, so that I will no longer be able to come back to have that perspective. So it's almost this incommensurability of paradigms by Roland Morgan.
Yes and no. I think it's...
Are we doomed to be in our boxes more or less?
No, around the opposite. I think this is just by getting out of the box and at least temporary and visit another box or a couple of other boxes and see what they say and how they do things and that you can bring in resources for starting to question some of your assumptions in your own box and then perhaps either expand the box or even to somehow renew the box in various ways. And I think that's the only way to do that. I mean, there are different levels here. You can be this high-level scholar, the independent scholar, who doesn't belong to any box, just to this hovering around above there and sort of do some touchdown, but essentially do independent research. And then we have the sort of middle ground scholar that may be jumping around in some boxes and but not really commit him or herself entirely. And then maybe you have the third category, some box researcher working on the margin, in the fringes, and there we can see some cracks and things that you can work on. And then we have the conventional boxes. So you can take different positions there too, I would guess.
Which one are you, do you think?
Probably the second. I'm sort of in some boxes, but not. I'm rarely commit to a box entirely. Never. I can't do that. And that's why I don't often present like EGOS. That's the box research conference, because the research boxes, the strategy as practice and emotions and trust, and you have it. You have to stay there. In one sense, that's good. You cultivate, in particular for younger academics, but it's also cultivating and strengthening the box. And I want to hear what other people have to say and to enable me to see something new, not to be confirmed and confirmed and confirmed. And that maybe it's more for a senior scholar if you've been in the box for a long time. You don't want to hear more of that. You want to hear something else.
Yeah. We actually had a discussion a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
We had this special from the OLKC conference with Paul Duguid and Emma Bell.
Yeah.
And we had this conversation about either being a neophyte of sorts or, being in your comfy little way of viewing things.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited you mentioned that. I was wondering that we mentioned that your book deals with two things primarily, gap spotting and problematization. Do you want to say a few words just what those things are?
Well, as I said, I think I said in the beginning, the book, the background to the book and where we identify the two ways to do research and to come up with contributions. And the most common way of coming up with contribution is to identify some gaps, a hole in the literature, and then fill that, add to the existing literature.
You had a vacuum metaphor and a pothole metaphor.
So there you have to vacuum clean the literature, as I said, to find. You go around with the vacuum and then you see, there's a hole. That's me. I can then fill that gap in the literature. So that's the gap spotting. You spot gaps in existing literature, and then you place yourself in that hole. But that the problem with that, I mean, it's sometimes good, in particular in a newer field, an emergent field, an emergent theory. You need to make that better, more robust. Then you may need to do more gap spot. But in more mature field, in particular where they got sort of stale, or sort of, then you may need to open up that, because there's not one more of the same. It's getting nowhere. It's just incremental. Then comes in this problematization, which means that in order to open up and say something more interesting, you need to challenge the assumptions underlying that existing literature, at least some of them, to then open up to see it in a different light, and then can reinvigorate that theory or that area there. But I mean, so there are the two things, the two ways of. And what we are saying today, people are doing far too much gap spotting. That's why we have this problem that is, as you said, there's so many people working so hard to so little effect. So relatively speaking, we get almost none now, or very little sort of impactful research that has a more lasting effect. So a lot of things just disappear. But the background here also is this current system. We are forced to publish, and the ranking system that sort of seems to create and reinforce gap spotting, which we're very concerned about. So we can't only look at the way we conduct research. We also have to look at the in social or institutional context in which we conduct research that sort of forces act up on us. Why do we do gap spotting? So we talk about that in the book as well, about the institutional norms that encourage ranking. We talk about professional norms that also encourage sort of gap spotting and likewise also identity constructions. There seems to be people want to, as I said in the seminar, that who am I while I'm publishing in those journals, rather than,
I love that story.
Yeah. And that you can go ask someone some conference yourself. Often they say that I'm publishing there, I have a paper there now on review, but they don't talk about what they do.
Interestingly, that doesn't seem to be the case when you approach PhD scholars.
No, because you're not really in the game yet. You're sort of occupied with your thesis.
They either tell you that they're not sure what they're doing.
No, that's right.
Or they tell you what they're actually doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know PhDs. Innocence, I suppose.
Yeah, I know PhD students love to talk about their topics. This is what I'm doing. Yeah, can go on for ages because that occupies your entire self.
So, out of curiosity, how did you choose the boxes when you fitted in when you were jumping from one box to the other, just to record the metaphor you used?
I started out my PhD on human competence. I found that interesting. I wrote a PhD on that, and I wasn't thinking in box terms.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage I didn't think about that at all. But now afterwards I can see that, as I said today, I think I did some kind of promotion of existing literature on competence theory, how competence is built up. A quite big promotion. That's why some people sort of, it's almost a new school in that area. It's still in the area of competence, but it's different ways of doing research. So I can say probably I belong in that box to some extent.
This is actually similar to a question that Ella from University of Sydney asked.
Yeah, I know Ella.
Yeah. So, hi, Ella. So she wanted to know what inspires your curiosity now when you start a new project, and I think that's relevant to what we just talked about.
Yeah, and I mean, nowadays I think I'm much more aware of these things. So will this question, this idea, will that make any difference? I will ask myself, will it have any impact on the broad audience? Because I think a number of people do make a mistake that they think they have identified something that would be very interesting, but it's often very narrow-minded. So I'm trying to do more bigger things that may have a large impact on the field. So if you take the gap spotting paper, that paper you have there, it applies to many people, not only practice theorists or qualitative, even to quant people. So it's a broad point. So we're trying to do much more of that and to think through that. Often, perhaps not doing so much box, still doing that. But I'm thinking, I'm having a project on professional skillful performance, where I'm trying to be more sort of come up with something that high relevance to practitioners, not only to theorists. So, but that did from the very beginning. Can I come up with something that will have a sort of material impact on the way we educate people and the way we train people in organizations, if I can come up with this way of conceptualizing?
I really love your romanticization of academia. it's very seductive, and that you're actually aiming to improve it qualitatively rather than improve the amount of boxes available or something like that. I was just wondering that if one is setting up to make the research more interesting or to pursue interesting research, presumably it's not a very rational process, and I gather that also from what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You don't sit down and look at the broad literature and then think, okay, this may be worth problematizing and then pursue that. It's almost more serendipitous or kind of phenomenological in a way that you're drawn to an issue, and then you have a choice whether to gap spot or problematize.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question. How do you come up with good ideas? It's sometimes, I mean, the good story is where Mats Alvesson and Andrew Spicer came up with a story about, they wrote a paper, and now they've written a book on stupidity theory of organization.
Yes, that just came up.
Yeah. But there's a paper first, and it's sort of counterintuitive, because you think, well, today we live in a knowledge economy and a lot of increased preferences and people a lot of knowledge. And then they say, well, people are actually stupid. Well, they qualify that as functional stupidity. So a lot of functional stupidity in the sense that people, they're clever in the sense they do what they're told, but they don't think for themselves. So they're just big blinkers, and that's what we do here, and they don't reflect on that. So that's the kind of functional stupidity there. But how did they come up with that? Well, the story is that they had dinner and they drank, they had used drugs. They had a few drinks and they started to play around with this, fooling around. And they said, hang on, maybe there's something in this. So the day after, I think Andres started to play around the maths too, and then the draft or something. Yeah, we can, this idea is actually works. So we can actually do something about it. And quite soon they had a draft of that paper. And that's an interesting idea because it took, people understood that quite intuitively. So even it came out, so Le Monde and other people took up that because they understood that. There's a lot of stupidity going on in the organization. So that changed people's view or helped them to understand that it was going on. So I mean, that's a way how it came about. I mean, another thing we are working on now, I don't know, maybe I should say it now, but Mats and I, that we came up with something called about pre-understanding. It's, I don't know if you know what that is, but that's what kind of input ingredients do we use to theorize, to come up with theories? Well, either data or theories. That's all what we use to generate ideas. But pre-understanding is the kind of our previous experience and the cultural background we have that sort of is there all the time. But science, interestingly, even since the Enlightenment, trying to, you should be objective. You should try to put away your experience, objectivity, biases there and just do science, research, and just rely on data and theory, nothing else. But we start to see maybe, while it's true that your pre-understanding can color what you're doing, but it's also a source, an enabler for coming up with new ideas. So that's a bit counterintuitive almost because we have sort of put away and now we're saying, so we develop a paper on just that idea that, and we demonstrate how pre-understanding can be used as an enabler in theorizing and developing new theories. It's the kind of research we like to do because it has a much broader impact than just a little trait somewhere.
There is some tradition of pragmatism on this.
Mm.
I think Persig, when writing was quoted, he used the metaphor of a freight train moving along, and while the train itself is your pre-understanding, as it were, what happens at the very front of the train as it's cutting through the air, that is your activity. That's fascinating. I guess if we were thinking about fostering more interesting research, what would be perhaps one thing that you would recommend a nascent researcher or an established one for that matter to go and do in order to start off on this interesting research path?
Well, they should read our book. No, but
we'll
yeah,
put a
but,
link up to you.
But I think that sort of, for me, it's been a very interesting journey to explore this. I said 6-7 years ago we started to explore this, what's going on, and I wasn't really aware. I hadn't thematized the way I was conducting research, the way I was setting up things, so because I was gap-spotting myself, of course, and I still do that. But becoming aware how you're actually setting up studies and how you do studies, and that the name, because if you don't see what you do, you can't change it. So I think it's important to be more reflective on this, and our texts here hopefully can be a kind of tool to enable people to reflect more on how they conduct research and then become aware of different ways of doing gap spotting, but also possibility to do more questioning research. So they expand the horizons of conducting research by these two different ways. And I think you should start today to problematize and because it's fun. And you can start brainstorming and see it's just a shift in focus from gaps to assumptions and see, because we may not even think about theories have assumptions, but of course they have. And if we put our attention to the assumptions, we start to discover them. And some of them are good, some of them are not so good, and then we can start to problematize it. And yeah, it's fun, exciting, you don't need to, some of them may be not very useful to problematize, but some of them can be very productive. So I think you should start now, even as a PhD student, not saying that, well, this is only for a senior scholar. I think that is too late. Having said that, I don't mean that you should be a complete problematizer and never do gap spotting. That's not what I'm saying. But you need to be aware of these possibilities and do more of that, and then you can become more independent researcher.
Definitely a first step would be identifying the assumptions.
This is a bit tricky. You can't just go and identify assumptions,
but at least
right?
Bearing it
yeah.
in mind.
Being conscious of that there are some, I suppose, is
yeah.
a good start.
I mean, exactly how that leads. I mean, that may be something that you work with some I don't know what you're working with yourself, but an institution theory or process theory, practice theory. Okay, I can apply practice theory or institution theory, but, and that will lead to some interest, maybe not so interest, but you can demonstrate that, but more interest perhaps can. Is there some, you feel that institution theory may have some limitations and not very happy with it, and can I find some way of problematizing it somehow that can lead to something more? I think that's the way you should start thinking about it. Not just apply a theory blindly without thinking unquestioningly. You will never be the one who actually make a difference. You will be seen as perhaps at best a solid researcher, but not the one that people will cite and talk about very much. So start today.
And that's all for special episode 15. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a positive review on iTunes or elsewhere, and feel free to get in touch via our website, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or even Instagram. Most importantly, however, please share the podcast with your students and colleagues and friends, and get more people talking about organizations. Also, if you're listening to this while at the Academy of Management conference in Anaheim, Pedro's there. So do seek him out and say hi. There is not a part 2 to this episode, as we only had about an hour of Jorgen's time, nor will there be a summary because this is a special episode. So next week we release episode 16 on the contingency theory by Lawrence and Lorsch, another management classic. For you to enjoy here on Talking About Organizations.